Do I have to admit that on the radio? I think it was...
like 20 years ago.
I think it was 19 years ago.
19 years ago, we did a program about teenagers and teenage depression, and Alexander came on with a bunch of teenagers and talked about it in such a way. It was a great contribution. Since then, she's gone on to become an extraordinary dancer, centerfold figure in the New York Times Magazine section at one point, featured about her and her work. An amazing, amazing dancer, now choreographer. And Alexander has been working on a piece, which we'll tell you about, which relates to the subject today, which is the concept of happiness, also in the studio with me. Another great honor. The venerable Nicholas Vreeland, who is the director of the Tibet Center, which has just moved, hasn't it, Nicholas?
It's moved to Dumbo.
Where is Dumbo?
Dumbo is down under the Brooklyn and Manhattan overpass. We're at 25 Washington Street area tucked away between the two bridges where they both meet Brooklyn.
Both meet? That's great. Dumbo. Did you know that, Alexander?
Yes,
you knew that?
Beautiful.
It's down around your neighborhood, mm-hmm. right? But isn't your dance? Aren't you dancing in Dumbo? Where are you dancing?
Well, we have a loft in Fort Greene right now.
But where is the place where your performance is going to be?
My performance is in Manhattan. It's on the island. It's down on Chamber Street at Dance New Amsterdam.
Chamber Street, which is not related to Dumbo.
Unfortunately, no.
You wish it were. Okay, well, let's talk about this. Here's what's happened. Look, an article came out in the New York Times. David Leonhardt shakes things up a little bit when he says they've done a couple of studies. Alan Krueger was a Princeton economist working with some psychologists. They did some studies on what makes people happy and what's the difference between happiness between men and women. And here's what they came up with. Over the years, men are reporting experiencing much more happiness than women. And when they tried to break that down, it seems that in the past, women used to be happier than men when they were at home and they were satisfied with their family life, but the two have changed place. And on reports, women talk about, you know, men have talked about having working and they work hard, but they use their hard work to find some leisure time, to relax, to lay back, to watch a football game, to hang out. Whereas women, on the other hand, have replaced their homework, their housework, with working in a place, and so she has like a second shift. Her second shift is coming home and working, and so that extra joyous time, that free time is not there. And that's kind of the beginning of it, but something is wrong with the whole concept as far as I'm concerned. I'll never forget a man I met who was Japanese who said, I am fascinated by the American desire to have happiness in their life. He didn't even know. He didn't know what this concept is, that we should be spending all our time trying to have. He called it fun. He said having to have fun. Why are Americans so concerned with having fun? So I take this question to two of the best thinkers that I know, Nicholas and Alexandra. And I especially relate to this because in this, Nicholas Vreeland from the Tibet Center is bringing in His Holiness the Dalai Lama next weekend, to Radio City Music Hall. Is that right?
Yes, to talk about
happiness. Maybe not fun. I think our pursuit of fun is what leads us astray. If we try to have fun, then we think of the fun as something out there, while happiness is something we have to cultivate within ourselves. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama is coming to New York to teach us how we can bring about true happiness, a happiness that doesn't depend on things, doesn't depend on events, doesn't depend on excitement. It's something we simply have within us, a peaceful state. So he'll be teaching for 3 days, October 12th, 13th, 14th at Radio City Music Hall, and he'll mainly be talking about the concept of emptiness, which I hope we can explore together today.
So, His Holiness the Dalai Lama at Radio City Music Hall, isn't that fitting? Will the Rockettes be there, do you think?
Well, we tried to get them, but no, they won't.
Because they could do Hello, Dolly.
They could do Hello, Dolly.
Hello,
yes.
Dolly. No, we will have, the Radio City Music Hall is going to be filled with the hearts of people who all have one thing in common, the search for an inner sense, the search for peace.
Yes, I suppose that it was important to have it be Rockette-free so that we derived our happiness not from seeing the Rockettes, but from developing happiness within us. I hope you won't disagree with that, Alexandra.
I absolutely don't disagree with that.
Well, Alexandra, what have you found in your understanding of or trying to explore this concept? Now, let me just explain to people. When you get a concept in your mind as a choreographer, you're a modern dance choreographer. You take that and you put it into a form of staging that involves sound, music, recordings, and dance and movement. And all of that goes together. And I've been to a number of your performances where it just gets all whipped out into, it's acted out. I mean, you don't have it, you know, here is this piece represents people who think they get happy from drugs. I mean, you don't get that kind of linear thinking.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I definitely like to start from some literal points because I feel like it's going to ground it home. I think if I go into the abstraction of, you know, trying to express happiness in a dance performance, it's so general that it's not human. You know, I think human beings are made up of a lot of very specific things, and our lives are made up of details and very specific relationships. And I feel like if I don't find that specificity on stage, then no, I don't make people relate to it as human beings. So in a way, I am dealing with the person who gets his happiness off of heroin. But then I want to take it away from the specificity of heroin and open it up to addiction and open it up to pleasure versus happiness. And so, say, for example, one of the things I've been thinking about is how some people take their memory of happiness as kind of a guiding point or a marker, and they say, I was happy once when this happened to me. So if I could make that thing happen to me again, I could be happy again. But that thing doesn't exist anymore, and the person that they were when that thing happened doesn't exist anymore.
I've had that happen so often when I go back to read books that I used to love. I used to love this book. I remember how much I loved this book, and I go pick it up and I read it, and I'm saying, what was I reading?
Right.
What was this about?
But does that mean that you weren't happy in that moment?
No, it doesn't mean it, but my memory of it doesn't mean that I could recapture the memory through that thing.
And also our memories are incredibly fallible, and we delete a lot of things along the way, and we remember a very specific feeling of happiness. So, for example, in this piece, at one point I have a woman's doing a very beautiful dance phrase, and a man happens on stage and sees her. She doesn't know that she's been seen. And he says, that was the most beautiful thing I ever saw. It made me so happy. It was so gorgeous. Will you do it again for me? And she does it again, but it's not the same for him. And he keeps trying to correct her and fit her and try to make it what it was. But he can't communicate it to her, and he can't make her into that thing that she once was for him. And he can't find that same happiness out of her. So they get into this very kind of human sort of love relationship disagreement. And she's incredibly disappointing to him, and he is incredibly disappointing to her, because they're searching for their happiness in each other, outside themselves, and in the wrong way. And they're trying to control it, and they're trying to make something happen that's not inside themselves.
Alexandra Beller, by the way, what's the name of the place where these performances are being done?
They'll be at Dance New Amsterdam.
DNA. I like that. As in the genes.
Yes.
DNA Dance New Amsterdam, and those are, when are those? It's going to be this weekend.
No, we open October 18th through the 21st. We have
so
follow.
So you don't. So the Dalai Lama is for people to go to on the 12th and 13th and 14th, and then they could go on to see you after that.
Good. And then they will be happy.
And then they will be happy. Nicholas, talk to me of emptiness.
Well, in what Alexandra just said, what was interesting was the idea that the dance performance that the man happens upon and pursues in respect to his wish for happiness is something that he perceives to be somehow concretely a cause of his happiness, that there is some quality within that dance performance that he sees that exists there among the movements that is the source of happiness. And we would say that this is a quality that we impute upon the dance performance. It's not a quality that exists inherently there. One of the mistakes that we make when we are attracted to things is that we believe those things to be inherently sources of happiness. If we begin to take the parts, take the pieces apart from each other, suddenly our desires diminish. Suddenly our belief that there's some sort of inherent source of happiness evaporates.
Give me an example of that, Nicholas. What would be an example of that? An example of what you would take apart, like being on this radio. No, pick an example.
You know, as an ex-photographer, I can talk particularly well about the attachment that a photographer has for a camera. And when we are working as photographers, we somehow feel that that particular camera is going to solve all our problems. We need that camera. And we view that camera as inherently perfect, that that's the one. We know that once we possess that camera, we need the lenses, we need another camera, and then with technology evolving the way it does, suddenly it's obsolete and we need a new one. If we analyze from the beginning, from when we first have the desire for that camera, the fact that it isn't inherently the perfect camera, that it's a bunch of parts that work well in a particular circumstance and situation, that eventually it is going to be obsolete, suddenly that diminishes our grasping at it. It diminishes our attachment for it. That brings us a little bit of peace. That brings us a little bit of happiness.
I have a wonderful story for you, Nicholas, that I think you'd appreciate. I was at the Grand Canyon with a bunch of friends, and we were all my friends, and I was a photographer, so I had two Nikons strapped around my body. One was a black and white, and one was a color. One had a long lens, one had a short lens, and an eagle came swooping by, and my friends were all looking up at the eagle, and they went, "Wow, look at this wonderful thing, and it's coming close." So I immediately grab from my 135mm lens, switch it to an 80mm lens, I take out the film, and I actually switch to a better film. I was using Agfa film, and I wanted to go to Kodak film, and I actually got it in the camera, and I got it all ready as the eagle came by. Just as it swooped down, I got the perfect photograph. Perfect photograph of an eagle swooping overhead, and the eagle flew away. And then I looked at my friends, and they were sitting there like they had just seen God. And me, I had a picture. And I said, all right. I was attached to the photograph. The photograph had much more meaning to me than the actual thing itself.
So the fact that we sit and talk about that, that you can recognize that, will diminish your need to possess, to capture, and will develop your ability to simply experience, which is a state of true happiness.
Now you have spent, people should know we're speaking with Nicholas Vreeland from the Tibet Center of New York, which is in Dumbo. I love that. Which is down under the
Manhattan-Brooklyn overpass.
Manhattan-Brooklyn overpass, how nice. 25 Washington Street, and Nicholas is, of course, in advance of, he's a friend of WBAI's, he's been with us, he knows Kathy Davis and Bernard White. And Nicholas is here to tell us about the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who will be here next weekend at the Radio City Music Hall, where there may be tickets available to see it. It's an expensive thing, but the whole thing is you can't possibly judge money to the concept. You know, the concept is there. It's what is it about? And you should also know that Nicholas wears robes in true Tibetan fashion. And I know I have to bring this up because we're talking about happiness. Nicholas had more exposure to a world that believed that its happiness was based on materialism than most people do. Right, didn't you?
Yes, though I think that everyone in today's world...
not like you did. We'll just give them a little background.
Well, I had a rather privileged background. My father was a diplomat. I was born in Switzerland, brought up in Europe, in different places, and led a very comfortable life. However, as I began to search for the meaning of life, I began to see through the illusions of the world that I was brought up in, and began to look for something more tangible in my pursuit for happiness. Because I think we all do pursue happiness. I do think that that's really what motivates us in life. I think even the Japanese man whom you mentioned at first, the Japanese man was pursuing happiness in his way. We all do. How we do it is what matters. And if we consider happiness to be that thing that's out there, we'll never attain true happiness. And that's what I began to understand.
We had a... there's a recent series of TV programs, television series, which have all been about focusing on the life of the wealthy. One called Dirty Rotten Money or something like that, Dirty Filthy Money. And there's another one that was all, these are all these programs which are about the kind of difficulties that you don't imagine that people would have when they had wealth. And I wanted to ask you, Nicholas, one of the things that you saw when you were around affluence, and you're around it and you see it and you could have just about anything you want, what makes you cross over from there into saying, you know, this, it doesn't work? What do you think? Do you think somebody touched you on the head with a feather or something? Do you think what made you ask the question?
To be honest, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when an alcoholic decides to turn to seek for help, mm-hmm. What is it that touches that person? It's usually hitting rock bottom. But is it something that they can actually point at and say, that was it? I don't know. And looking in oneself and saying to oneself, I'm going to look for happiness in a different way, is something that I don't think one can actually put one's finger on. I think that it's, from a Buddhist perspective, the tendency to look inwardly, to seek a spiritual path, is something that comes with us from a past life, from many past lives. So you have this tendency that comes from past experiences. And due to your past actions, you are born within a comfortable, privileged situation. And due to these other past actions, which were the pursuit of something inward, you eventually start looking inward.
I'm interested to ask you, Nicholas, about the camera. Because it struck a chord with me, because I would say that as an artist, one of my greatest sources of happiness is the creation of art. And I can relate to the photographer who thinks this camera is going to make the picture that I want to make. You know, this dancer or that theater or the ability to create a certain set that's going to express something that I want to express is a great source of not just pleasure, but happiness to me. I mean, I feel when I've made something that I really believe in, that I feel really that was what I was trying to say, and my inside has come out, and I'm able to share it with people and ask them the question that's been cycling in my spirit, I feel like that's a great source of peace to me and happiness. And yet I'm thinking that there's a sense of the attachment, you know, to the outside, that's inherent in what to me is actually a very deep internal exploration. So I'm interested in turning that question to you.
Well, I can't relate to it so much from the point of view of a choreographer whose tools are dancers. I'm glad that you gave it to me in terms of the tools that a photographer uses. As I went off to the monastery 22 years ago, I discussed with a friend of mine, a photographer, what kind of camera I might take along. And he laughed and he said, any camera you use, it makes no difference. It's a recording device. And if the process of taking pictures is not seen to be, let's say, the process of capturing, but simply sort of like the way one might write poetry, a process of jotting down a few words and then working on them and getting them to express what you feel in life. If the camera is simply the tool by which you do that, it doesn't matter what the camera is. It makes no difference whatsoever. It's like a tape recorder for picking up sound. Of course, a better tape recorder is going to pick up sound better. But if you're just trying to pick up sound, use whatever you have and accept whatever you have, because one of the true secrets of happiness is to be content with what you have.
Now, that's a big one right there, being content with what you have. So we know that if you go to Radio City Music Hall next weekend, you're going to be sitting with, how many people can they seat?
6,000.
6,000 people. Imagine sitting with 6,000 people who all wanted to spend 3 days being in the presence of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, assuming that, you know, out of that 6,000, 20 of them are priests. We now have the rest. What a nice group of people. I think just as a place to be. And what they would be saying is, I am in the presence of my own happiness. I mean, I am here. And I am here and I'm unattached for 3 days. I mean, that's basically in itself a state of being. And I think you're saying, Nicholas, that it's like settling with what you have, being here, being present, being now. Not with what you're going to get tomorrow, not with where you're going to get lunch after Radio City Music Hall. That's part of the path to it.
Well, I think it has something to do with what Alexander was saying initially, that we invest so much in some concept of happiness, some future. We want things to be a certain way, and that will provide us with happiness. And we work so hard at that, that we don't actually experience happiness. In the same way that you, in trying to take your photograph, were working so hard at that, that you weren't simply experiencing happiness. And I was telling friends last night about a time when I was asked to take a photograph, a portrait of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I was all set up with this large view camera and putting the sheets of film into it to take a photograph of him. And after one sheet, another sheet, a third sheet, I knew I hadn't gotten my photograph. And he suddenly said, okay. And I said, no, Your Holiness, I don't think I've quite gotten the photograph. And he said, we must be content with what we have. And he left. And it was devastating. The next time I was asked to photograph him, as soon as he said, okay, I said, thank you very much. And the first shot was the photograph. And I had prepared myself to be content with what I had.
Hmm. Which is a great it's a great lesson for an artist, to try to be content with what they have. I was talking to a fellow choreographer at one point, saying, you know, the problem with being a choreographer is that basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to be brilliant. Right? You have this idea. I don't want to make a, you know, I made this piece and it's okay. It's so-so. It's not very interesting. You know, I'm trying to make something that's going to move people, is going to tear their, you know, shells open and reveal something about themselves to them, or about their environment, about their community. And basically what is required of that is brilliance. And so you're trying to be this thing that is kind of rare and maybe impossible, unless you accept that brilliance is whatever you're offering in that moment. Like, that is your brilliance of the moment. But I was also struck by what you were saying, Armand, that 6,000 people would be there and they would be in this experience of emptiness and present moment. And I think it's a beautiful hope, but I doubt that it's true that all 6,000 people are really going to be in that state, because I think that in this country, we give so much honor to what's outside of ourselves that we think is going to be the thing, right? The answer, the secret to happiness, the this, that I feel sure that within this country, even some of those 6,000 people will be there to have their problem solved and have their happiness given to them by somebody else who's not actually there to do that, is there to reveal something that is already inside them. But if people are still looking outside themselves for that thing, I think those words are not necessarily going to penetrate.
Though I would say that anyone who goes there, has the wish to go there, has the belief that there might be some wisdom that His Holiness will provide, is at least open to the idea of some change being
absolutely.
Possible.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And, you know, I hope that that's true and that just the experience of being there shifts that practice for them. But I would hesitate to think that all 6,000 people are going there and, you know, they already know that they're going to have what they're walking in with is what they're going to walk out with, you know.
So this is Armand DeMille with Alexandra Bella from Dance New Amsterdam's performance. She's a choreographer. And Nicholas Vreeland, the director of the Tibet Center. And there's going to be this big thing with the Tibet Center, which is His Holiness the Dalai Lama is going to be at Radio City Music Hall. And you know we should have lunch, don't you? Oh, I hate this. This is my joke. But there's a Frankfurter stand right outside. It has a big sign that says, One with Everything.
May I add that the Tibet Center and Healing the Divide are both are co-sponsoring this event. Healing the Divide is the foundation established by Richard Gere, and we together have invited the Dalai Lama to New York a few times. The great events in Central Park, which you have attended, were organized by us together.
Is that different than the Gere Foundation?
Well, it's it seems to change. There is something called the Gere Foundation, which was the initial foundation he created, and then there's a public entity called Healing the Divide.
I like it. This is Armand DeMille with Alexandra Bella and Nicholas Vreeland. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little bit of music, and we'll continue with this discussion about the concept of happiness and as happiness relates to two concepts, which is emptiness and loneliness. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. And this is Armand DeMille back with you with The Prophet of Mind. What an interesting remix that is. Tony Scott is a clarinetist from many years ago. I knew him many years ago. And he went to the East and he came back with some beautiful music, a music called Music for Zen Meditation, an album by Tony Scott that's phenomenal. And then recently they've taken it and they've done this Hare Krishna King Brit Funk remix, which just another one of those incredible stretches of the brain. This is Armand DeMille with you. It's A Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm sitting with Alexandra Beller, a choreographer who's putting together this new piece on happiness at the Dance New Amsterdam next weekend. Not next weekend, I'm sorry, Alexandra, when is it?
It's in 2 weeks, October 18th to 21st.
October 18th through the 21st. And with Venerable Nicholas Vreeland, director of the Tibet Center in New York, who is co-sponsoring His Holiness the Dalai Lama coming to America and being at Radio City Music Hall next weekend. So we're going to go back to just and I think off air we had a small. An interesting discussion about the concept of happiness and what people perceive as happiness. And I want to bring to you, Alexandra, that there's a rule in radio. One of the rules in radio, and the reason that Nicholas Vreeland does not have an ongoing radio program, is because what you would get is an invitation to join peace and quiet, and that's not what people want. People want energy. If a thing doesn't have a strong energetic field that punches out at you, people will not listen. People will not attend, both on radio and on television. So that's why we see so few people who represent inner peace. I mean, the Krishnamurti videos we see, you know, somewhere on private television or on local television, but nobody wants to see that. Nobody wants to see anybody getting silent, being calm, that's not what we're interested in. What we're interested in is Madonna and the likes.
Well, one thing that we were talking about during the break in the studio is that what I've been investigating in part in my dance theater work is the image of happiness that we encounter in this country and that we're saturated with in this country. The popular images, the game shows, the even in the music industry, even, you know, the popularization of this dance show, So You Think You Can Dance, which is really one of the only mainstream places that people see dance. It's the images of quote-unquote happiness, I think, are actually more akin to images of mania. They're out of control. They're screaming. It's intense, like overwhelming euphoria. And I think that we get conditioned to think of those images as what happiness looks like. And when we don't look like that, I think sometimes we mistake the peace of happiness for nothing. You know, like we look over it. We overlook the calm and the sweetness that comes with, you know, holding your baby or laying in bed with your love or alone or being, you know, watching the sun, just sitting. And we overlook a lot of those things because they're not what we've grown up to associate with happiness. I was cruising through some channels with my husband at one point, and we paused for a moment on some game show, and somebody won something, and just screaming her head off, just absolutely out of control. And he turned to me and said, "I could never be on one of those shows because I could never be happy like that. You know, I could never express my happiness like that." And I thought, I don't think she's expressing happiness. I think she's been coached to overact her pleasure.
There's another thing to it, though. I mean, from what I see, there's a chemistry associated with that kind of manic reflection. You know, you hit the home run and you're jumping up and down, your chemistry goes off, and there's a chemistry of happiness which you can easily become addicted to, which is why people do bungee jumping and all the other things. There is a chemistry that's not available. Now, I'm going to say something that I'm going to say through meditation. You can get to the very same chemistry that you get through orgasm, but it's a longer road because you don't have as many things to hold on to. And that's why I think people get addicted to the externals to find happiness.
I also think that one of the things that gets in the way is the misrepresentation of pleasure as happiness. I think pleasure and happiness are two different things. I think happiness brings a certain amount of pleasure. But I think that pleasure doesn't always bring happiness, and that we have fused the two often. And I think happiness is a much deeper, more long-term, more state of being, and pleasure is a sensation that you arrive at in a given moment. And I think that when we shorten the span of time and we think, like, this moment is pleasurable, but does it bring you great happiness? And it doesn't necessarily. And I think, you know, giving up heroin doesn't give you great pleasure in that moment, but I think it brings your life a state of happiness. Even if you really dig down, in that moment, it brings you a state of happiness. Even in the midst of your great displeasure. Having never taken or given up heroin, I can't speak as an expert, but from what I read, you know, I think the happiness that you attain at giving up some of your less worthy habits greatly outweighs the pleasure of them, but we fuse them.
May I address this whole idea of pursuing happiness? The example that you just gave of the woman who wins the jackpot and is exuberant, that is a happiness that comes from some outside stimulus. And that moment of happiness, which is euphoric, is one which will end. And then in order to attain that, she will need another such moment. And she won't be satisfied with only having won $1,000. She'll get used to it eventually, and she'll need $10,000, $100,000, etc. That the vicious circle of desire and the need to satisfy desire is insatiable. And therefore, we would say that the true method of bringing about happiness is to bring about a diminishment of desire, a diminishment of the need to satisfy oneself, the need to have one's desires actually satisfied, and develop, as I said before, contentment. One is on the outside and one is on the inside.
And how do you marry that with the idea to affect change in the world?
Well, you know, people turn to a monk and they say, what effect do you have on the world? How do you help things? I mean, if you were a doctor, you'd be out helping people. If you were making a lot of money that you could then give away, you would help people. But how does a monk help? And it's a sort of tough one to respond to. There is this Muslim saying, which is the unwise man tries to change others, the medium wise man tries to change his environment, while the wise man tries to change himself. And I saw on a church the same thing, a sign saying, many people try to change the world, few try to change themselves. I honestly believe that the greatest contribution that we can make to the universe is the work that we do on ourselves, diminishing selfishness, diminishing anger, developing selflessness, developing generosity.
So I would take that to a larger level and say if you succeed at some deep level at developing those things, in particular generosity, probably within a state of contentment, you can still affect change. I mean, my
you do affect change. You are changing, and your change within yourself affects the universe.
I think part of my question stems from the fact that my desires, often deal with creation of art. And lately my desires also deal with the happiness of my family. and trying to affect a change in my environment, which creates happiness or creates a piece of art that is beautiful and affects other people. But inherent in both of those things, I have desires for more time, more space, more support, artistic support, you know, and those things are absolutely desires. I don't have a state of contentment within that.
And they
that.
Cause you anxiety,
yes.
They cause you stress,
absolutely.
They cause you unhappiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what would you, all right, let's take it on. Good. Alexandra Bella, one of the most creative humans I've ever met. She worked a lot on herself. This is what's beautiful about hearing you talk, Alexandra, is that you ask questions about yourself non-defensively, which I love. And so you learn about yourself. You know, Alexandra Bella was a former dancer with the Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane Dance Company. And she's working on America's obsession with happiness and using humor and what comes after happy and why must we appear to the world. But here we are with this question, you know, Alexandra. So you say yes. And when I create, I feel wonderful in the creative flow. And I get in that groove, and I know that groove. I feel wonderful. And Nicholas says, yes, but along the way you feel stressful and pain. And you say, yes, but when I get there, it's worth it. And Nicholas says,
is it?
All right. And what would you say instead?
Well,
give me an alternative.
When I became a monk, the day I became a monk, I was so excited. I was so happy. And I went to see the abbot of the monastery that I belonged to. And he said, oh, you look very happy. You look very excited. That's maybe not so good. We must bring down that happiness. And we must work at developing a steadiness. Because with that attitude, we can go a long, long way. And he said, you know, you're not going to attain enlightenment in this lifetime. It's something that takes many, many lives, and you have to steady yourself so that you can continue this process from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime.
What about emptiness, Nicholas?
Well, emptiness is the state of being of myself and of every phenomenon that makes change possible. We would say that it is due to the fact that we are empty of inherent existence that we can evolve spiritually. If we were inherently existent, if there were some core, true, permanent self at our core, that couldn't change, that couldn't evolve. The recognition of our lack of such a self, such an unchangeable, permanent self, is what makes the process of cultivating true happiness possible.
Yes, okay. But let me ask you then, Nicholas. So that, I mean, that's a nice kind of thing to say to yourself. You know, I'm a work in motion. You know, I'm a piece that's being developed. I'm not there. I'm never there. Whatever piece I might feel might be wonderful, but I'm always on my way. Is that what you say, Nicholas? I'm always. You can't settle down and say, I'm here.
Well,
you know?
Let's look at it from a different
now
point
that
of view.
Now that I'm in Dumbo, now that I'm in 25 Washington Street, I've arrived.
Well, we can never say that, because as soon as we arrive, we then, if we have that attitude, we wish for the next thing. However, I should say that it is due to our belief in some sort of a self that we wish to satisfy this self. And that's what grasping at things comes from. That's what desires come from. The desire all stems from the concept of self from which the desires come, that wishes to be satisfied. Anger is something that comes out of our wish to have things a certain way and have them not be a certain way. So that all these problems, all these afflictive emotions that we have actually come from the fact that there is a self at the core, or our belief in the self. If we recognize that there's no self, Suddenly there is no desire. Suddenly there is no anger. Suddenly there is no pride. Suddenly there is no arrogance or jealousy. All these emotions have no basis because there's no self at the core.
Can you go to that just a little more? What does it mean, no self at the core? There's, at the core there's something, or is there something?
Well, come to Radio City Music Hall, because what His Holiness the Dalai Lama will be talking about is just that, that when you really analyze, let's say we all have an idea of ourselves. I have an idea of who I am, and I can actually conjure up a concept of myself. I can develop a certain pride in who I am and what I've attained, and I can hold on to that concept. Now I look among the parts to see where it is. Now, is that concept the physical me? Is it the mental me? If it's the physical me, then as the physical me changes moment by moment, that self will change moment by moment. But I believe it to be concrete. If it's the mental me, it also exists from moment to moment to moment, evolving within circumstances which this concept of self that I have doesn't. We have the feeling that we have this sort of, that we are unchangeable. We thereby come to recognize that there can't be a self separate from the consciousness aspect of the self or the physical. And according to the Buddhist concept is that therefore there is no true inner, inherent, independent me. That there are simply the dependent aspects of consciousness and the physical aspects, which we impute a concept of me upon.
And that's an interesting thing, right, Alex?
Well, this is a little bit off the track of the self, but I'm interested in what you were talking about in terms of contentment, because one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately is kind of America in particular. I mean, I'm very steeped in this culture since I've grown up here. But America's kind of refusal to be content with any emotion other than happiness. There's kind of a lack of respect or lack of space to really experience fear or sadness or any other emotion than happiness. I feel like happiness is valued more in this country than other emotions, and that barring tragedy, even within tragedy, you're kind of expected to recover a certain length of time, and here's how you recover from it, and these are the steps that you take to get rid of your pain, as opposed to kind of honoring wherever you're at in that moment. And there is a certain, it reminded me of this idea of contentment. You know, your love dies, or your child dies, or something tragic happens, and there's going to be grief and there's going to be pain, but there's also the idea of having a sense of contentment within that. I think, I don't know that I would have used the word contentment before sitting here with you, but what I would call is valuing those emotions or honoring where you're at in that moment. And I've been looking at how we kind of whitewash other emotions in this country and what that does to us, like how that kind of fragments us and builds things on top of our true emotional state.
What do you mean by whitewash? You mean we don't give it any real bearing?
No, we cover it up. We whitewash it. We cover it up with things.
Give me an example.
How are you?
Uh-huh.
Great. I'm great. And I say it every day. How are you? I'm great. I'm fabulous. And I could have just had, a total meltdown at home because I didn't want to leave my baby at home or, you know, something. And I'm not great. I don't feel great. I feel really sad or I feel really torn. But I don't, we're expected not to say that to each other. And then if you do say that or even go so far as to be like, you know what, I'm really incredibly happy, I feel wonderful, I feel euphoric, people don't want you to say that either, because then there's the comparison. I compare my happiness with yours. If you're happier than me, that makes me not happy. Or, not we necessarily in this room, but I think as a culture there's a tendency to do that. And so I think we whitewash everything that's not kind of middle of the road happiness.
Well, talking about other cultures, among Tibetans, if you're asked how you are, you always answer, "I'm well." I lived in North Africa when I was a child, and there, when you ask someone how he is, he'll say, "He's well." And how are your children? They are well. And how is your wife? She is well. And then you can push farther, and then you discover that the wife is very sick, and one child just died, etc. But that comes up afterwards. The initial thing is everyone is well.
But if you're a Buddhist and you're with your Buddhist buddies, if you're with your Buddhist buddies and you're hanging out and your friends, and you say, "How are you?" But you know, you just lost something, like one of your parents died or something. Do you still say, "I'm well"?
Yes.
So that's a reminder to yourself. The "I am well" is a reminder to yourself that you are well. You're not just saying it to kind of get rid of the other person.
I'm not sure. Maybe you are. maybe it's just a politeness. You don't dwell on your own problems. You simply say, "I'm well," and keep a smile on. And there is that attitude that you don't complain, that the less you complain, the happier you'll probably be, because to indulge in your complaints and your dissatisfactions only leads to unhappiness.
And that does lead to a belief in them, you know? Yeah. That which we repeat, if we talk about it often enough, we do get to believe that these things are real. You know, we believe those things that we're unhappy about and that we're not happy about, and that the other things will make us happy. You get to believe it the more you talk about it. That's why it's a good idea.
Well, you know, I think that you can believe your own story to a certain degree, but I think that it does some harm to you to be making a story above what's actually happening.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I think that your real story disappears somewhere, and I think inside your real story is real happiness.
The wisdom of Alexandra Bella, dancer, who with Adele Myers is going to be doing a weekend, a Dance New Amsterdam, 2 weeks from now. It should be exciting dance. It should be really exciting. And when you go over to Alexandra, make sure you introduce yourself as having been heard on WBAI. And the Venerable Nicholas Vreeland, who has brought the Dalai Lama to, His Holiness the Dalai Lama to Radio City Music Hall, which is going to be a remarkable event next weekend. Is that Friday from, what are the hours?
Friday from 10 to 12 and 2 to 4, Saturday from 10 to 12 and 2 to 4, and Sunday from 10 to 12.
I thank you both. How do they get tickets to that?
Go to DalaiLamaNY.org or go to Ticketmaster.
Ticketmaster will have tickets to the Dalai Lama?
At Radio City Music Hall.
That's amazing.
And he's teaching the Diamond Cutter Sutra, which is a sutra by the Buddha, and the 70 Verses on Emptiness by Nagarjuna.
Wow. And you know it'll be there 2 hours before the event?
Probably best, because security is quite tight.
So it'll be a lot of emptiness. I'll be back with you, my friends, tomorrow. No, Tuesday. Oh, no, I won't be with you Tuesday. Now we start the marathon. I just thought about it. The marathon starts, and I'll be bringing you a special on Wednesday. Next Wednesday, tune in. I will not be with you on Tuesday at our regular time. Tune in next Wednesday. You're going to hear me doing a two-hour presentation, 1 to 3 p.m. Again, Alexandra Bella, Nicholas Vreeland, thanks for being with us. I'll be back with you next Wednesday, my friends. If you want to check on our marathon schedule, you could go to thepositivemind.com, www.thepositivemind.com. Alexandra, how do they reach you? How do they get tickets? What do they do?
They can get tickets through dnadance.org.
dnadance.org. Thanks a lot, my friends. Be back with you on Wednesday.
beach alive.